Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 22nd, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Marvin Landsverk. Today's session number is 99-2, and it's titled Emily Dickinson and the Living Word. Let's listen in.
The title of this session is Emily Dickinson and the Living Word, and it's part of a series on poetry I've got going this week called Leaves from the Tree of Life. Yesterday, we talked about Dylan Thomas, and today it's Emily Dickinson, and just a quick explanation of what's going on with this. I teach English literature at Montana State University, and I thought it would be fun just to rummage up some poets who deal with tree imagery in their poems. So that's the basic premise for these. So each day a new poet and of their poems, I've tried to select poems that have something to do with trees. And today it's Emily Dickinson. And part of the other aspect of what we've got going is what I like to call a parabolic method that I'm using. And parabolic in the literal sense of, I guess, the etymology of the word parable, which, as we all know, means a type of a story, and comes from a word that means comparison, to make a comparison. One thing is like another. That's what parables do. I mean, Jesus tells stories, and he says, the kingdom of God is like, and what am I going to say it's like today? Well, like the mustard seed. And parable is a great word because of the thing that I like best about it is that this aspect of the serendipitous, because it means literally to throw beside. And to throw one thing down next to another and then see what happens. And that's really the way I love to look at words. I mean, that's certainly what poets are doing constantly in one way or another. They're throwing words next to each other to see what happens. When we're reading the poetry of Emily Dickinson, one thing we're asked to do certainly is to see how she throws words one next to another. But when I'm using this term parabolic method for this series this week, what I thought would be fun would be to take some of her poems and throw them next to texts from the Bible that also have tree imagery in it or have something to do with the imagery that the poem is evoking. To throw then scripture next to poetry, one next to another, to see what happens. And I mean, there might be a number of reasons to do that. One would be to engage in some sort of scholarly source study to say, did Emily Dickinson really have this thing in mind when she wrote this text? Which is an interesting exercise to speculate, but it's not really my primary one today. What I'm more interested in is just to see what happens. Whether she had it in mind or not, and sometimes it'll be fairly obvious that she probably did, but even if she didn't, what happens in your mind, which is really where I'd like to go with this, when we set a poem next to a scripture verse that's using different images, and what kind of thoughts grow in our minds when we do that. So that's the parabolic method. I'd like to make one advertisement. Today is Emily Dickinson. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the poet who I do most of my academic research on, and that's William Blake, the 18th century visionary. And there, since he illustrated his own poetry and was as famous as an artist or is now as a poet, we'll be looking at slides of his images of trees. And then I'm off Thursday, but Friday will be Robert Frost. And then Saturday, if you're still here, the title of that session is Gathering Leaves, Holden Poems. Now, for there to be a session on Saturday, you will need to gather some. And write some. So I'm inviting you, or pleading with you, to get inspired between now and then and write a poem. And it doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be serious. I mean, you could try to be serious, whatever. Try to write a tree poem. or a poem that engages the summer theme of the Tree of Life, and see what happens. So we'll deal with what comes on that session. And just to inspire you in that direction, I'm going to show you one quick poem.
Is that it?
No, it's in the front here, way up at the front.
This?
Yeah. One thing that I have been doing lately is I go around in Bozeman where I live to my kids are in grade school, so I go into the grade school classes and I do some poetry and residence thing and help them write poems. So this poem is one that we just did. It was as a group poem. The younger kids, I don't have write individual poems at the very beginning, but we go. I teach them techniques about parables. I mean, throwing things next to each other, and they brainstorm it all, and I just smash it together. And this is a poem that my daughter's third, it's a split class, third and fourth grade class, then just put together in May. And what I did, I just picked some crabgrass on the way and brought it in. I said, okay, let's write a poem about this. So they all got a piece and they looked at it. And this is the poem, Crabgrass. It's not quite a tree, but it's still living green stuff, so I thought it was close enough. Why does it make my parents so crabby? It's beautiful. A new racetrack with lanes. Each spear is folded in the middle like a boat's keel, gliding silently down prairie streams. Amongst the darker, shorter grass, it looks like a silk scarf, ribbed, with zebra stripes waiting to be picked up and smoothed against your face. Look how it sprouts, everywhere, like bouquets of shoelaces in the lawn. Ouch, but stepped on, sharp, a snake, it bites, and pulled between your fingers sticks like a dry water slide, or discarded corn husks. Who needs this kind of beauty in the lawn that grows two for every one my parents pull and turns their smiles to stone this green Medusa's hair? So there's an invitation to, try something.
And I would just say that if you don't feel comfortable writing something on your own, then find two or three people. You never can tell if you're looking closely at something. You'll each come up with different images, but you can put them together and make something together. Should I turn the machine on?
Yeah, why don't you until I get back to it? Thanks. If that one's scary, which actually that one is a little scary to me, to think, that's a good poem they wrote.
Yes.
So I wrote one which isn't scary. And I don't know why I've got limericks on my mind. I wrote a limerick for yesterday, so this is another limerick I wrote. This isn't a tree poem, but it's about Dylan Thomas, who we were talking about yesterday. So here's a limerick about Dylan Thomas. There once was a poet named Dylan. To mash words to mist, he was willin'. Rage, rage, green fuse Thomas with weird images bomb us. To clarity, he was a villain. So you can do that well, I'm sure. I'm more interested in poems than biography, really. So I'm just going to say just a few things about Emily Dickinson, which is good because I actually don't know that much about her since I'm a British lit person. But it helps at least situate. So, 19th century American poet. One of the big ones we're talking about here when we're talking about American literature, 1830 to 1886, and her father was a lawyer. She's from Amherst, Massachusetts. And, as sort of everybody knows that doesn't even know her, she was a weird, sort of funny duck. Which means, I suppose all poets are odd in some way. But she really was a recluse for a good part of her life. And had some close friends, and then lost some, and then really just sort of retreated into her house and wrote poetry. And really a completely uneventful life. And yet someone who's living this life of the mind, that is just absolutely fantastic. And it's a great paradox just even to think about, which is a good word to keep in mind and worth even writing up here, because I'd like you to keep it in mind when we look at her poems. Because many of her poems are built on paradoxes. She did have some friendships through correspondence along the way. I mean, documented that. I mean, she was sort of sending out feelers. She wanted somebody to read some of her poems, although most of them she wrote on these little funny packets and strung them together. And then when she died, there were over 1,000 of them, just sort of all over the place. And then published after her death. She didn't publish her work, and it's a interesting thing just to go through and sort of see, I mean, how you even go about publishing work like that when it's not known what order they're written in, I mean, how you would even organize it. And then since her punctuation is strange, all the early editions were quite bad. In fact, I ordered some of these to see if I could get up here, and they'll probably get here tomorrow. These nice little thrift editions of some of these poets I'm talking about, so they're only $1, so you can, for $1, read some poems. But interestingly, I mean, this edition, these poems have titles. And I was reading through these, and they also have semicolons in them. And I was reading through these, and you think, I mean, Emily Dickinson never used a semicolon in her life. I mean, the poems are here, but this isn't a scholarly edition of them, so it doesn't have her funny punctuation. And it does change. You'll see how she likes dashes, and she doesn't use titles. I mean, we can stick titles on her poems, but it alters them to treat them in that way. Just a couple things about her main themes, which will help us, I think, when we start to look at some of these poems. Much of what she wrote about was what was going on around her. I mean, changes in the seasons, a bird she'd see out the window, a fly buzzing around in the room. I mean, those would be the impetus for her thinking. But her poems really aren't just about the natural world. She was interested in essentials and getting to the heart of things in a sort of philosophic fashion. And her method then of doing that was to use, what you might call gnomic language, cryptic language, concise language. It's an epigrammatic style in a lyrical form. Now, what exactly does that mean? Well, one thing it means is you read her works and they sound a little bit like reading proverbs. Ah, which is one reason I like her, because I'm very interested in proverbs. I mean, that's one reason why I like William Blake so much, is because he wrote all kinds of proverbs. And that's what my book is on, is Blake and the biblical wisdom tradition. But her poems are lyrical poems, very simple rhythms and a simple form. And so to marry together this sort of simplicity of form and this sort of cryptic, compressed style, makes her poems immediately recognizable when you see them, and gives an interesting aspect of this paradox. I mean, simplicity and complexity sort of all at once is one way to think about what she's doing. And I mean, there's another thing that's said about her work, besides the fact that she's always dealing with great themes of love and death and speculating on just what those mean. There's a quote about her that said that her vision was focused like the eyes of birds, that is, in opposite directions, on the two worlds of the material and the spiritual. Now think about that, and think about the Bible study even for a minute that many of you have been going to. I mean, to be looking at the spiritual and the material worlds at the same time puts her at the edge of the apocalyptic. And it's useful to think about Dickinson's poetry really with that could have been my title today, The Edge of the Apocalyptic. And to see where she goes with that will be one thing that I'll invite us to be thinking about even right now. I mean, is she getting messages from beyond, or is she not? But she's got eyes, certainly, that are focused on both at once. And the other thing, back to Proverbs for a minute, and back to our tree theme, one of the images for wisdom in the book of Proverbs, besides the fact that Proverbs is personified as Sophia, the actual speech of God, as we heard about at a session yesterday, but also wisdom is said to be the tree of life. I mean, that's why wisdom is the tree of life. Emily Dickinson doesn't exactly play with that directly, but her proverbial style makes her poetry itself, I think, I mean, in as literal a fashion as we can think about, leaves from the tree of life, because it is a sort of a wisdom poetry. Okay, so enough by way of introduction, and I like introductions so much I could keep introducing and never get anywhere. So what I'd like to do then is get to it. And again, the it will be my method. I'm going to ask you to look in the Bible, since the Bible study this morning didn't have us looking there in the Bible study. I thought maybe at a session that isn't a Bible study, I could have you look at it. So I'll just have us peek at a few verses, and then we'll read a poem, and then the rest of this is not a lecture. What I'm interested in is a couple questions. And I mean, it was a couple games even. I mean, one of the games, I said I picked tree poems and tree scriptures, is just simply to play the game, find the tree reference in the poem, which in a short poem is easier than in some of Dylan Thomas's. But we can think about that. And the other game here is to play, you know, what does Marvin have in mind asking us to think about these two things together? Although that one I'm less interested in then is, what do you see when we put these two things together? Okay, so let's begin. And I sort of packaged these, and I don't know how many we'll get through, but Dickinson has a number of images of trees, certainly as the tree of life in a very positive fashion. I mean, this is true with lots of poets too. But the tree of life isn't the only tree in the Garden of Eden, as we know. I mean, trees are also imaged in other ways, and there are trees of death, or trees that lead to death or falls or something else. And so there's plenty of those types of trees in her work as well. So I sort of lumped these together as sort of more favorable tree imagery, and then we'll make a transition and look at more ambiguous tree imagery. Although I think that ambiguity probably is there always, and it's probably always there in the scripture references. Okay, so let's start, and where I'm starting is in the book of Revelation. 22:2. Do I? Yeah. I was grinning at him. So 22:1-2, we'll read. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. It's interesting even just to stop there and just even think about that. I mean, what does that mean? On either side of the river is this tree of life. I mean, what's happening there? Is this stream sort of flowing through this? Is it straddling? You've got the sort of division image anyway, but here's this tree of life, which is the reference text for the summer theme. Okay, I mean, just a little short image there. And now we can flip that thing back on. This is, I mean, her poems are known by their first line, so to my quick ears the leaves conferred. And some of these I've got, so you can read along. I don't have them all on overhead. Sometimes it's fun just to listen to something and not read, but you can do what you want, but I'll read this and you can think. To my quick ear, the leaves conferred, the bushes, they were bells. I could not find a privacy from nature's sentinels. In cave, if I presume to hide, the walls begun to tell. Creation seemed a mighty crack to make me visible. So, the start off, is there a tree in that poem? Is there a tree reference? Leaves, okay. So. Bushes and leaves, and again, the way I think about it is, I mean, the burning bush to me is also the tree of life. So whether it's tall or short, but I mean, so we've got some trees. So this is a fair poem. At least it makes my list. It's also a poem like many of hers. I mean, that it's paradoxical. I mean, it's not immediately obvious what she's dealing with. And again, my interest in reading poetry often is not even to ask, what does this mean? Which is usually a discussion-ending question in a class. Because then all the students sit there and say, well, you tell us so we can write down the answer on the test. And what a horrible way to think about poetry. If that's what, you know, we're after. I mean, what I'm interested in is what happens in your head, what do you think about when you are set next to those words and when these words are set next to this image of the tree of life in Revelation, if that leads to something. So, I mean, does anybody?
In the garden, no place to hide. Once after the fall, you can't hide. In the trees or leaves, you can't hide. In the cave, it's always...
So you see a fall reference even already in there. Yeah. So like Adam and Eve trying to find a place to hide after they, yeah. And certainly, I mean, that's one of her themes she's constantly dealing with, and there's some other poems that deal directly with Eden and the fall. So I think that's great. Anything else that sort of makes you think of? And again, I mean, you have permission to think of something that's not even there. That's what I, you know, when I read poetry, often one thing that I find myself doing, that's when I write poetry. You know, I'm reading something and all of a sudden, oh, your mind starts going someplace.
Yeah. All creation seems to be just there so that she can become. It's the crack in the wall, but it's also the sound. That
yes.
Cracking sound, which makes visible
yeah.
the sight.
Yeah, creation seemed a mighty, I mean, it's a description of this thing there, but yeah. This noise, crack. I mean, that's, I mean, that's the Big Bang, pow, you know, and creation is there. And again, what we know, what makes creation, just some way to think about it, is language. God speaks. Words are one of the things that create. I mean, poets constantly love to think about that. I mean, poets are writing words and engaging in creation, which if you're a mystic poet, like William Blake, will see it really exactly as the same thing as God creating.
I see in a kind of image of it, knowing a little bit about Emily Dickinson being rather reclusive.
Yeah.
Very reclusive. That it's almost as though she can't withdraw from nature,
yeah.
Creation. She can withdraw from a lot of other things, but not from that. It forces itself on that.
It's there, and the other thing that I think about when I read this, and I don't know if she's got this on her mind, but I mean, it makes me think of Plato and Plato's dualism and Plato's allegory of the cave, which you may be familiar with or you may not, but remember that story. Such a foundational story for Western thought, you know, the way we think about everything. I mean, there is the material world and there's the spiritual world, and here we are at the edge of the apocalyptic. I mean, if you're there between the two and you only look at the material world, I mean, then the other doesn't exist. But if you know that there is some other world there and you're in tune for hearing something from it, I mean, there you're in the place. I mean, in this poem, it seems to be someone who's sort of afraid to hear messages from that other side. But think about the allegory of the caves for a minute. Remember that story. Plato tells a story about these people that are chained inside this cave, and they can only see the wall, I mean, like this. So, I mean, here's the example. I mean, all I can see, my whole reality is that shadow, and that's the world. That's existence, because they can't see behind them. And one of them gets out of the cave and goes out and stumbles and into the light and sees that the world they thought was real was just this world of shadows. And there is a spiritual or an other, I mean, the real world that's out there. So you go back and you tell those people inside, and then they kill you. Because that's reality.
No, psychologists could have fun with this, because there's a certain amount of paranoia.
Right.
A big deal of it.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's puzzling and it's beautiful. And that's, I mean, Proverbs, back to Proverbs, many of the book of Proverbs, not many, but in a certain section, are riddle proverbs. I mean, in the sort of riddling tradition. I mean, it sort of asks questions, what's like this? I mean, there's a riddling aspect to many of Dickinson's poems. I mean, it's as if try to guess what the title of this poem is. And that's why editors that are probably too enthusiastic sometimes do. Let's keep moving on. I've got a bunch here. So next one is the Hope poem. And I'd like you, for fun, to turn to Job 14:7. One result of this method, even if this parabolic method doesn't do anything, that you'll have a few more sort of tree references in the Bible sort of programmed into you. You won't need a concordance to find them. Okay, so Job, book of Job, what did I say? 14:7. So, book of Job, I mean, I just love this book anyway. The Shakespeare of the Bible, it really is fantastic. But I'm just looking at little verses. For there is hope for a tree if it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its shoots will not cease. Though its root grows old in the earth and its stump dies in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and put forth branches like a young plant. And it goes on to make a comparison, but mortals are going to die. So we got another tree image that certainly is the tree of life there. But it's a tree of life that's got death right beside it. Okay, and here's a poem. Can you see it? My Hope poem, there. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. This is a good one for sitting on a porch at Holden and watching hummingbirds, which is what I've been doing a lot the last 2 days with my kids. What goes on in your head when you see that one? What do you see? What do you think about? I go back to my even easier question. Is there a tree in that poem? Yeah, maybe. I mean, you got a bird that's perching on something. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a bird poem, though. How about play? I mean, why am I reading that line from Job with this poem?
Whose extremity?
Is that the question you asking here?
Yeah.
Yet never in extremity, which could mean extremities is.
Yeah, but who? Well, hope's extremity. If hope were in an extreme anguish, it doesn't ask a problem.
The closest pronoun reference back would have to be the bird.
And you're suggesting extremity even means fingers? Is that like?
Possibly, but also it's the poet's extremity, where the poet is strung out, stressed
right.
out.
Yeah.
The poet is not out.
Well, if you've ever cut down a cherry tree or a prune tree, yeah. nothing's there, but all of a sudden, several feet out, there's this little sprout.
Right.
That's whole.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what the Job, that's certainly what the Job line is talking about. You cut down a tree and life still's going to be there.
It's always giving, never asking, yeah. just like life is.
I mean, that's the punchline of this poem, isn't it? I mean, hope makes you go on even when you're cooped up in your house and you're sort of depressed. And doesn't ask for something in return. Let's keep going. This next one is interesting. And the place I'd like you to start is in, we're jumping all over the place, Matthew 14, 22. This may be stretching, looking for trees, but... Matthew 14, 22. And I hope that's the right place. I haven't got there yet. Yeah, where is it? You found it? Read it. Oh, yeah. I mean, I should check what version do I have here. Oh, well, I'll read. I don't know why I got here. Immediately he made the disciple get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, he came walking toward them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear, but immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Okay, that's where I want to be. No tree there, but here's a poem about a ghost. The Holy Ghost. The only ghost I ever saw was dressed in Mechlin, which is a beaded fabric. I had to look it up. I didn't know either. The only ghost I ever saw was dressed in Mechlin, so he wore no sandal on his foot and stepped like flakes of snow. His gait was soundless, like the bird, but rapid, like the roe. His fashions quaint, mosaic, or haply mistletoe. His conversation seldom, his laughter like the breeze that dies away in dimples among the pensive trees. Our interview was transient, of me himself was shy, and God forbid I look behind since that appalling day. Now that one's not immediately obvious to me. You see anything going on there? I mean, I never read poetry ever without a dictionary sitting next to me, so I brought this one in, you know, just in case somebody needs it. So,
well, we've got a hopeful bird back.
All right, birds. Emily Dickinson loves birds. She loves bees. Bees are buzzing everywhere in her poems. And anything else you recognize? Is that the Jesus that the disciples think's a ghost? Or is that just sort of a happenstance connection?
What's the meaning of road?
Yeah. A deer. Mm-hmm. How about, what do you make of his fashion's quaint yeah. mosaic? Mm-hmm. What's a mosaic?
Like
means two things at least. It means like
pattern, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it means if you make a artwork out of dots, or like Moses. I mean, here's a poem about somebody in sandals, or not sandals, walking around like a ghost, and all of a sudden we get Moses invoked. I mean, Emily Dickinson does have the Bible in mind when she's writing a lot of her poems. I mean, she does. And, I mean, I doubt she had that passage in mind that I just yanked out of there about seeing Jesus as a ghost. That's just sort of an interesting thing. And yet, I mean, Jesus, Moses, someone walking up to you. I mean, you think about, I mean, this person that walks up to you, if God walks up to you, or one of the prophets, that, again, we're at the edge of apocalypse there. If a prophet shows up, they're going to tell you something from beyond. Is that a good thing to Emily Dickinson? What does she do when that happens? I mean, and where does this poem end?
What do you make of the last two lines?
That's the big question. I mean, I think in reading all of her paradoxes is, I mean, she gets us to this edge of paradox. I mean, you're going to break out of the Plato's cave and you're going to walk outside, and then the movie ends. It's like, okay, now you decide. I mean, and she doesn't ever quite give us the message. Yeah.
Lot's wife.
What was that?
Lot's wife. Salt, yeah.
Not looking back.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, that may be a good thing not to look back.
Shows distrust.
Yeah. So if this is Moses or God coming and tells you something, then you don't have to look back again. Or it might be you're afraid to look back. I mean, if this angel, whatever, is still back there, I mean, it makes you a little nervous if you've got sort of God walking around beside you. And I mean, I'm not sure, you know. I mean, the word appall is not a happy word. I mean, it means to make pale. Yeah.
The other biblical story that comes to mind for me is Lot and his daughters. I do look back, and it is an appalling day. It's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I see more in it a hopeful thing, that she is beckoned to look forward.
Right. And that's how I like to read her poems. But again, the imagery with the tree of life always, and because maybe just that's the human mind, that's the way it thinks, you can't help but say tree of life and think, oh, what about the tree of death? And
well, it's, that's there too, because mistletoe is a parasitic plant.
That we also then use,
which is poison,
to think about kissing. So
it's a strange thing with a day. The end that she blows her rhyme scheme out in the last word.
Right. Yeah.
Thinking Australian.
Yeah, right.
The word would rhyme starts out with die.
Right, yeah, and that's a perfect way to say it. I mean, a number of poets sort of lead you, tease you to think it is going to be that word, and then they change it. And it's, I mean, your brain thinks die as you read day. Mm-hmm. But it's not die. Is that hopeful that it's not? Or is it scary that we think about it even when someone's not even talking about that? That's
how about were it die, that game of chance?
Right, yeah. Yeah, well,
I just have a question. You said appalling means turning pale?
Paul, pale.
Just appalled.
To be made.
Paul also has that. What covers the casket.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And has connections to be made silent too, I think.
Any insight into why she capitalizes certain words?
She likes to capitalize nouns especially. And again, early
except she uses mosaic as an adjective.
Yeah. Her early editions of her work sort of got rid of them all.
And then ones that could be Moses mosaic back then.
And part of it is, she uses the capitalizations, I think, to help just emphasis in sight and in if you're going to be reading these poems out loud. There's more. How are we doing? Oh, that's all right. Okay. Now, I'd like you to go to, I've got a pair of poems here where we'll start in Acts 2. Acts 2, 1 through 8, very familiar, you'll see. when the day of Pentecost had come, and they were all together in one place. And suddenly from heaven there came a sound like the rush of a violent wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. Divided tongues as a fire appeared among them, and a tongue rested on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other languages as the Spirit gave them ability. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, more language. Okay, so the Pentecost story. And what sound do you hear? This rush of wind. Okay, so then I am get the next page, Kay. It's like the light. And these two poems sort of, I mean, who knows if she wrote them anywhere near each other, but they're similar. It's like the light, a fashionless delight. It's like the bee, a dateless melody. It's like the woods, private, like the breeze, phraseless, yet it stirs the proudest trees. It's like the morning, best when it's done, and the everlasting clocks chime noon. It's another one of those almost rhymes at the end that catches you. This is a riddle poem. I mean, it's sort of cast as I'm telling you a riddle, guess what I'm writing about. Now, you know, what's the answer to the riddle?
Wind.
That's the title in this edition. This poem's called The Wind. So it's sort of, I mean, it's no fun if it's it says The Wind. I mean, you don't have to guess. That's, yeah, that's what's very fascinating. I mean, if this is a riddle poem, why does it have the answer in it? It's, I mean, how can the wind be like the wind? So, you know, maybe it isn't the wind if it's like the breeze, but certainly, I mean, this is a poem that's about the breeze.
It's about the Spirit.
The Spirit, about a voice speaking that can move things. I mean, it isn't just the wind. I mean, in the Pentecost text, the wind is connected to fire, is connected to words and language. And I think, I mean, she's thinking a little bit about that. Anything else you see in that one?
Does the act still say like a wind, or there was a wind?
I think it, well, this translation is, suddenly from heaven there came a sound like the rush of a violent wind, so.
And then there are flames as of or like fire.
Right.
So it's a riddle text,
yeah,
as well.
It's making analogies of a certain type.
And Evan, you pointed out already that it's an almost rhyme. If you read it as, and the everlasting hawks chime down, then the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is eternity.
Chime, like, it's like, it's timeless then. Or a scarier version of that is if, when time stops for you, you're dead.
But then you go back to the whole thing and it talks about fashionless and dateless and things that go well with eternity.
Yeah.
What about best when it's done?
Yeah. I mean, this sounds like a hot stove image, you know, it's like it feels good when you get off. I mean, that's the wind. I mean, that's why it's not just the wind, I think. I mean, when God is speaking to you someplace, I mean, Moses in front of the burning bush, I mean, often those stories, it's not a completely pleasurable experience. I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, painful even. I mean, a lot of mythology. I mean, in fact, if you come face to face with a deity, you usually get fried to a potato chip. And, you know, I mean, and so here, you know, I mean, if the wind is somehow related to the voice of God when it's over, then you can go back to your reclusive words. And here's another wind one, which is next. The wind, let's see. The wind tapped like a tired man, and like a host, "Come in," I boldly answered. Entered then my residence within, a rapid, footless guest, to offer whom a chair were as impossible as hand a sofa to the air. No bone had he to bind him. His speech was like the push of numerous hummingbirds at once from a superior bush. His countenance a billow, his fingers, as he passed, let go a music as of tunes blown tremulous in glass. He visited, still flitting, then like a timid man, again he tapped, 'twas flurriedly, and I became alone. What I want to say about that is, I mean, that's just a great poem. It's just a great poem. She's just economical. Well, that word doesn't capture it.
You think she's talking about something spiritual?
Well, again, I mean, there's
maybe the Holy Spirit.
There's that visitation. There's that visitation. And again, I mean, if her eyes are focused both on the spiritual and the material, I mean, part of it, I mean, she's looking at a hummingbird on her porch, I mean, like we can do here, and that makes her think of something beyond, but somehow, I mean, that presence of those things itself gives this
so
knowledge.
It wasn't the body, because he had no bone, but yet his speech was there.
Yeah, the buzzing. The host, the term host in here is a wonderfully ambiguous word. I heard last summer here Walt Wangren talking about host and telling some host stories. Host means both, I mean, in its etymology, the presider at the banquet, and we know it's the heavenly host and the angelic host, but back to the presider, host also means guest in its sort of roots. Someone who was a guest, who was also a host, sort of bringing those two things together is just sort of a wonderful sort of Christian image.
It evokes in me the words of Jesus, "I stand at the door and knock."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As guest and host,
yeah,
both. I mean, and here even the grammar, "The wind tapped like a tired man, and like a host, come in." Was the wind, was this tired man the host, or was the poet the host? Yeah.
Well, read the whole sentence, and like a host, "Come in," I answered.
Right,
if
you...
I don't know where the sentence starts.
It could be the way it's tapped like a tired man, like a host. Come
right.
In the
whole
answer.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it invites you to think, I was the host, so I said come in, and yet, I mean, it does turn it around. And there's that burning bush. I mean, it's not a burning, but that bush is back here. Moses, I think, is on Emily Dickinson's mind, as is this edge of apocalypse again, this there. Okay, how are we doing? We end at, what, 20 after?
Was about the muse, was about inspiration, was the visitation of that which sparked your poetry.
Right.
I'm fascinated that this wind taps first like a tired man, but leaves like a timid man. And I think those are so, that is very different, tired and timid. The energy, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I guess I've always seen this poem in particular, and some of these other wind and spirit poems, how she struggles with where inspiration comes from poetry. When she visited,
And she did fret about that a lot. I mean, she spent her life writing these things. I mean, early on, when some of her correspondence, she sent off a few of her poems and asked, "Is there breath in these poems?" Was her question.
Inspiration.
And she got back responses that were favorable, but no one had seen anything like this, and they didn't know what to make of it. He said, "This is something, but..." but I mean, and in that point, sort of, I mean, what poetry looked like wasn't this. She's ahead of her time. And they said, you know, it's not really publishable because this isn't really poetry. But it's good, so keep doing it. So she did, but she didn't publish it.
In any case, if I were to link this with a biblical story, I think I'd link it with the Visitation or the Annunciation, not Visitation.
Yes, yes.
But there is this the Gabriel figure, the one with the message who comes in. Because this timid man business, I mean, there is this letting a man into your chamber too for her, is, I mean, that's a very complicated piece. Comes tired, leaves timidly, but when he goes, the tapping is flurriedly. And then she's abandoned again. And I think of Gabriel coming to Mary in this, and then the next step is the pondering. What do I do with this that is just blown in and blown out, boneless, speech coming, you know, I just love that, like the push of numerous hummingbirds. I mean, doesn't that sound like angelic speech? You think the rush and the push. So I would have put this with denunciation.
Yeah, that's
just for the fun.
And at the opposite end, I see after the resurrection coming to the frightened disciples in through the door. Don't touch me. Rush.
Oh.
I mean, appears.
So the John
leaves. You know that.
And the difference with it, though, to both those stories, is in both those stories they leave filled and they leave in communion and with Christ, whereas here she becomes alone again. And so I think there is the dismal, the negative aspect to this treating this poem.
But alone doesn't have to be dismal.
No, and
no, but it's different than the biblical stories.
No, I disagree about the...
You disagree?
Yeah, the marriage story, okay. She is left alone. Suddenly she's alone, and that's why she has to run through the... through the countryside to greet Elizabeth to not be alone. I mean, there is this.
But isn't she filled in some way too that this doesn't quite capture in the same way?
To be alone does not mean you're alone and empty.
Okay, no, I just asked.
She might become alone and full just like Mary did.
Mm-hmm. I guess my impression with the poem, and I can't back it up necessarily from the text or the words, is that this is an empty alone, more so than it is with Mary.
That's the way I felt too, that it's empty. She's disappointed that...
That's interesting, I mean, if it...
No, she's
alone.
If it is just the wind tapping on the window, you know, it kind of startles you, think, oh, is there someone at my window? And, I mean, that would imply, I mean, there was no one there. Mm-hmm. When she says, I became alone, I mean, then she wasn't alone at some point in this poem. I mean, there, for a while, there was something there, but...
I hear this as the aloneness out of which poetry does come now. This is the reflecting upon in tranquility after the overflow, I mean, after the visitation, it seems to me. I think that's very pregnant alone.
Well, let's
hear it. Timid man.
No, let's try that out. I won't give you a verse for this one. I'll just give you the poem, and then you see. I mean, what? I mean, this is a great crowd to play this in. You don't even need me to sort of give you a verse. I mean, this is... So let's look at a poem and see what happens. This is two different light poems, and one of these is one that you probably know, even if you don't read Emily Dickinson. It's the second one. But, the first one, a light exists in spring, not present on the year at any other period when March is scarcely here. A color stands abroad on solitary fields that science cannot overtake, but human nature feels. It waits upon the lawn, it shows the furthest tree, upon the furthest slope you know, it almost speaks to you. Then as horizons step or noons report away, without the formula of sound, it passes and we stay. A quality of loss affecting our content as trade had suddenly encroached upon a sacrament. So any takers on that?
What's it?
I think the it throughout most of this poem is this light. There's a certain type of light. It's because she writes this next poem is about light.
The color, then.
Yeah.
Light, a color, it.
I mean, there's a certain type of light that comes, it's in spring, it's different from any other, and it does these things.
It's rebirth of the earth in the spring. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fertility, spring. I mean, after the winter, I mean, certainly that's part of what's going on here. And there's a certain thing that happens in springtime. I mean, this poem makes me think of, and probably because I was talking about Dylan Thomas in Wales yesterday, but I mean, it makes me think of this anyway. When we lived in Wales and in this valley, it happened very frequently. In the evening, about 4 o'clock, you know, it rains all the time there, but the sun would start coming down, and it would come in under the clouds at a certain point, and this yellow, very interesting color would zoom in and fill the valley with the lid of clouds still on it, and everything would really, you know, be altered in just this fantastic way, and then when the sun would set, I mean, it just left you feeling like, I mean, you've been blessed, but also you were suffering some kind of a loss. And this is like that wind poem, even in that sense. I mean, you've got something and then you don't.
That's the thing I was thinking of, is that you were talking about empty or being alone. This says it passes and we stay. It's a little bit of a lament that it couldn't last longer. And so, you know, the last poem was not necessarily emptiness or alone in a terrible sense, but just wishing maybe that it could last the event or the relationship could last longer. And so this light has come, and she just wishes that it could be longer. Wow.
This tree in this poem then too is like this boundary marker. The edge, I mean, as far away as you can think, is I mean, this light shines upon that. The farthest tree on the farthest slope. I was going to do a day on Wallace Stevens. I don't know if anybody reads Wallace Stevens here. He's great, but he's, you know, modern American and weird. But he's got this poem. It's called, I mean, it's titled "The Palm at the End of the Mind." About this tree, as far away as your sort of imagination can go. I mean, it's very similar to what's been imaged.
The other thing it reminds me too is of the seasonal quality that comes in there too, because depending on where you live, but there's oftentimes, if you're in the desert, it doesn't make bloom for just a day or two, or if you're in a place where you've had a long winter, and then you get that spring green, that really vibrant green for a day or two. And I've had times when I had to be out of town for a week and I came back and I had missed it.
Yeah.
And then you have to wait an entire whole other
year.
Right. Of course, you still get the beautiful fullness of summer, but there's something about that first spring green.
Yeah.
Just a day or two when things sprout, and it's so fresh, and it's a different color than the rest of the green.
Yeah. We were sitting around telling tree stories last night, and I mean, that I couldn't think of a very good one. I mean, that makes me think of mine. I mean, and it's a Holden story. When we came up to Holden one year, I mean, in Bozeman, trees don't bud out until Memorial Day, if then. And then when they do, it's like this great thing because summer's so short. But we left right when the trees were all leafing out to come out to Holden. And when we got back, it was winter. 2 weeks later, because caterpillars had eaten every single leaf in the whole downtown area. It was like, I mean, as you say, I mean, I missed it. I missed summer in Bozeman, and I was only gone 2 weeks. But amazingly, all those trees then re-leafed, which I guess just about killed them. But let's look at this next one is one of her most famous poems. We're going to be running out of time, so I guess this is a good place to stop, although there's all kinds of other ones. If anybody wants to look at a book later, you can grab one of these. And if they come into the village this week, you can buy one. There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar but internal difference. or the meanings are. None may touch it, any, 'tis the seal, despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death.